Welcome to the latest Red Star Bulletin, focusing on the main news of the day, this being the 11th of November 2022, ironically enough coming to you therefore on Armistice Day. So, we'll be looking at the latest from the Ukraine conflict, or more accurately, the conflict between Russia and NATO that happens to take place on the territory of the country that was formerly known as Ukraine. Going to be starting off with a look at the main military updates, then turning to the diplomatic arena before concluding with some questions from the listeners related to Ukraine and other things as well. And as this daily broadcast evolves, I think what we're going to be doing is taking more questions and also broadening out the scope of subjects. So on Monday of next week, the bulk of the broadcast, though it will cover the latest from the Russia-NATO war, will be focused on the implosion of the cryptocurrencies and the latest scandals around that, and how we can take a look at this from a Marxist lens, and what the analysis offered to us by using the Marxist method can tell us about cryptocurrency and why it rose and why it is falling. But first, let's turn to the situation on the ground in Ukraine. Now, obviously, the major news from the last 24 hours was the Russian pullout from Kherson and the accompanying sound and fury which came with that as to whether it was part of a deal, whether this was part of some sort of Russian collapse, and everything else that you would associate with any move from the Russians that could be subjected to a propaganda blitz in the West, or the silence from the Russian command as to what tactics they're actually pursuing, it leads many others to fill that gap with speculation. Now, the situation is a little clearer today. Yesterday, I spoke a lot about the potential of some kind of deal, and that remains to be seen whether this will emerge or not. It certainly seems as if the Russian leadership have been out denying that there is any kind of deal today. Dmitry Medvedev, the deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, today said that whilst he understood the hysteria that came from certain quarters with regard to the abandonment of a Russian city, that Kherson was still a Russian city, that the Russians would be back. This was echoed by Putin's official spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. And Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, denied that the discussions with Sullivan, Jake Sullivan, the U.S. national security advisor for Biden, were about anything other than de-escalation of the nuclear talk. So talk of a deal has somewhat perhaps been overstated. Again, we remain unconvinced as to what exactly is going on. And will this be in any way advanced at the G20 summit? Putin himself, of course, is not going. I don't really blame him. It seems like a bit of a waste of time. Lavrov is going, and as of course, the various members of the US administration. Now, will that mean that they all have some kind of behind-closed-doors discussion there? Who knows? But certainly, the statement made by Zakharova, the spokeswoman of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, about negotiations, when you looked at it and the actual official translation, said essentially nothing new. It said that the Russian government would be ready for negotiations, but it didn't look as if the Ukrainians were serious about negotiations, given that their position hadn't changed at all. Now, Zelensky, having been told, presumably by the Biden administration, to amend his position, backed away from the Russia must have regime change rhetoric to just Russia must withdraw completely from everywhere and only then can there be negotiations. So barely a change at all. So was this somewhat overstated? Who knows? We need to wait and see how it goes. But the crucial thing for today is that the withdrawal from Kherson City still, of course, leaves 60% of the Kherson region inside the control of the Russian Federation. It also should be emphasized that the Russians executed a very orderly withdrawal from the front line. And I covered the vulnerabilities of the frontline position as it did exist yesterday. Essentially, the Russians had 30,000 men and over 2,000 pieces of military equipment, so vehicles, etc., inside that that pocket on the western bank of the Dnieper River, with the bridges blown out and the ferry crossings blown out, which had been very efficiently done by the Ukrainian armed forces using the full scope of the weaponry they'd been given by NATO, and of course, NATO satellite communications and targeting systems, which does enable the Ukrainian armed forces to have a degree of superiority when it comes to actual targeting and coordination, because the NATO equipment is just better at that than the Russians have as of now. Perhaps the Russians are now racing to learn from this and catch up with it. But essentially, Suravikin's statement as to why they were withdrawing does, militarily speaking, make a great deal of sense, though, as I've said before, there is no such thing as a purely military decision. The prospects of having to resupply that grouping of 30,000 men when the bridges had largely been cut off, when the ferry crossings had been blown up, when the armed forces of Ukraine did have a certain superiority in their firing positions, apparently, in that region, would have been presenting the Russians with a series of very difficult logistical problems, which they might have been able to solve, but would have taken a lot of resources. And ultimately, the decision that's been taken is it's not worth expending the resources to hold that area, even if, with 30,000 troops there, the Russians could hold that area, and indeed were holding that area up against the last Ukrainian attempt to take it in September. And, of course, the Ukrainians lost an awful lot of men in doing so. So the military calculus was that, as of right now, that they don't need to hold that area. It's not militarily crucial at this moment. And withdrawing to the east bank of the Dnepr River enables them to take up a better firing position and doesn't really give Ukraine too much of a military advantage, though, of course, as several Russian military correspondents have pointed out, it does enable them to have a better firing position at Crimea still. So there is that downside to it. But so far, it doesn't look as if, judging from the fighting on the rest of the front line, there has been any immediate change in policy. Russian forces continue to advance up near Ugledar, which I've mentioned before, and took the strategically important point of Pavlovka. The Russian assault led by the Wagner group inside Artemyovsk or Bakhmut, depending upon which Russian or Ukrainian pronunciation is your favorite nomenclature. And the Russian forces have liberated the strategically significant area that is surrounding Donetsk airport. Now, if you look back to the beginnings of the war, not of course in the early part of this year, but back in 2014, what a very different world it was for all of us then. The Donetsk airport battle was a grinding battle that went on for months and months and months between the Ukrainian armed forces and the various militias raised by the Donetsk People's Republics. And the battle then was very bitter and lasted a hell of a long time. So taking that back is obviously a significant point for the Donetsk forces, which are, of course, now Russian forces. So what does this tell us? It tells us that, of course, that the even if there was or is any deal, tacit or otherwise, being developed by the Russian government and the Biden administration, the Russians aren't obviously going to stop until they've taken all of Donetsk, the People's Republic territory, at the very least, and, of course, have continued to inflict damage on the armed forces of Ukraine, which the Ukrainians can't restore. So let's return again to the prospect of whether this is a deal or not. Let's look at the other possibility that I looked at a little bit yesterday but didn't go fully into, which is that even if there was talk of some kind of bargain, that it's not going to emerge for quite some time to come. The Ukrainians are certainly not going for it. They're apparently employing an extensive lobbying operation inside Congress, the newly elected Congress and the departing Congress of the United States. There's no obvious change given the announcements that have been forthcoming from the NATO nations about more aid for Ukraine, we must help Ukraine, etc. Of course, a lot of this is caveated to death with at some point in 2023. So keep in mind that the announcement is not always the same as the detail of the announcement. That a lot of these things that have been said are announcements of things that may happen at some point in the future next year, which may well be too late. So let's look at the other side of the coin here, which is what if there is no deal, or what if it's just talk of a deal? that doesn't go anywhere? What if either Ukraine doesn't accept it or the deeply divided Biden administration can't force anything through its own protracted internal bargaining? Because keep in mind, there are some, including probably the CIA director Burns and the military headed by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, who Milley at least has been leaking to the press, as is his traditional style, that he is in favor of a negotiated settlement. And of course, these are reportedly comments he made internally, but he let them be leaked out to the Washington Post and others because he is clearly in some kind of internal wrangle with the hardliners inside the Biden administration who want to push this further. Milley, of course, is no anti-imperialist or anything, but he is in a position to know what the US military can and cannot actually deliver. And I think on this point, someone like Scott Ritter is correct when he said in a recent interview that the US military, for all the talk of the US leading a 90,000 strong force into Western Ukraine, it's not something the US military can deliver upon if the Russians actually start shooting back at them. Because their allies don't have the actual ability to sustain a force in a battle situation. Because as I've said before, the Poles and the Romanians don't have the industrial base to sustain a war. They don't have the governmental strength to actually sustain a war. You could argue maybe the Poles do. The Polish petty bourgeois nationalists have a bit more organization. The Romanian government is a basket case. The Romanian bourgeoisie is very politically weak. They wouldn't want to try and draw upon the support of their population to fight a war. Wouldn't go very well, I don't think, for them. And of course, the US is already in a situation where they are having to strip their arsenals bare to send weapons to Ukraine. In fact, they're starting to say no about sending certain advanced weapon systems because they don't have the capacity to replace it. Bear in mind, the US military industrial complex, meaning the actual industries that produce the weapons, these have all been designed for the past 20 years to fight low-intensity counterinsurgency operations. To actually get these things turned around to war-level production is going to take a hell of a long time. And they certainly can't do it in the next 3 weeks or 6 weeks to the end of this year. This would take to re-establish the level of production that was required, for instance, during the Cold War, would require an enormous investment. Mainly from the US government, because certainly the US supposedly private, though in reality extensions of the state, companies like Raytheon, Boeing, etc., they aren't going to be doing the investing. The US government would have to pay them to expand their factory capacity inside the United States. They'd have to source a hell of a lot more raw materials, maybe some of them from Russia, because certainly the Russian titanium trade keeps going, as has been the talk on Russian Telegram today. So the idea of putting a force into Western Ukraine is a non-starter unless you're a lunatic. And Milley, whatever else he is, isn't a lunatic and knows very well that they couldn't sustain a fight against the Russians and probably knows from his conversations with Gerasimov, the head of the Russian armed forces, that the Russians aren't going to agree at this stage to any kind of NATO or American-led force entering Western Ukraine. So far as we know, anyway, that position hasn't changed. So let's think about, assuming that there is no bargain here at the moment, what is the other likelihood going on, which is that the Russian special military operation, even though the Russians are still insisting on calling it that, is having to be reconfigured into a war setting. Now, this has several different pieces that are moving at the same time. First of all, you get that new committee that Putin set up, that Mishustin, the Prime Minister of Russia, chairs, though Putin has run the first two meetings of it himself, which is all about putting certain of the industries of Russia onto a war footing, and mostly the defense industry and its related support industries and supply lines. And that's a first stage that would imply that if they're looking at any kind of deal, it certainly is not something which is in the immediate future. Secondly, of course, there is the mobilization, there is the equipping of the troops, and then there is also the moving them into position and the reorientation that they're needing to do inside the battlefields of Ukraine itself. You see, as I've stated on multiple occasions before, the initial push in Ukraine that was the special military operation in its original form wasn't designed to last anything longer than a couple of weeks, I don't think. It was designed to either knock over the Kiev government very quickly or force a negotiated settlement. Almost worked, didn't quite do that. Then, of course, they had to reorientate themselves and fight through the Donbass through the summer. And then, of course, they reached the point where they didn't have enough men to do that, and they needed to do a call-up. And now they're having to reorientate all of their forces inside Ukraine to build a more solid and compact front line, which is what the Kherson withdrawal might be all about, to replenish the units on the front line with the mobilized troops and with other troops coming from inside Russia. Because, of course, not all of the mobilized men are going into the front line. Some of them, at least, are going to other places inside the Russian Federation where their presence will enable more experienced troops to be released from border duties, guard duties, security, and other military operations and sent to Ukraine. All of this turnover, the build-up in Belarus, the building of a combined army group with the armed forces of Belarus, all of this is taking a long time. And they're having to reorientate all of their forces inside this area of operations to ensure that they do have the correct balance of forces in place for any offensive that does begin, depending upon, of course, what kind of offensive is going to be launched. And certainly I think that an offensive is coming, or some kind of offensive operations are coming, especially to finally drive the Ukrainian armed forces out of the Donetsk People's Republic. That's certainly the case. And that will be something that does take place over probably December to January. Of course, what happens in the future after that is another question. Do the Russians go back to up near Kharkov? There have been some combat operations up near there. It's a city that the Russians may well want, and certainly it would make strategic sense in terms of the final outcome of the war if the Russians can manage to get themselves a more secure border, i.e. not having a potential NATO operation go all the way up to their borders near Kursk and Belgorod. And of course, Kharkov is a traditional Russian city. There'll be a lot of political pressure on the Kremlin to take that. And as somebody on the Slavyangrad Telegram channel posted today, the last time Kherson was liberated back in the Second World War, the offensives actually came from the north, not from the south. It came at the city from the land way in rather than the river and sea way in. So we'll see. Certainly, I would still expect at this stage, given that what the official statements of the Russians are, given that Biden's statements on any kind of deal repeatedly contradict themselves, and that is probably due to the differing factions that are giving Biden his lines at any given time, or Ron Klein, his chief of staff, having to reflect the different factions in the administration by giving Biden contradictory lines to say at different points in any given day. Of course, talking of Biden, this leads us to the US midterms and the fallout from it. Now, there's been a very interesting response to this from the Republicans and the sort of the MAGA people, or the American nationalists, I think would be the more appropriate way of putting it. And a lot of them, of course, blaming Mitch McConnell and the various other Republican leaders in the House and the Senate, saying that these people are completely useless, they didn't even want to win anyway, that all they're interested in is moving money around. Maybe all of that is true. And of course, Trump himself distinguished himself by having an epic tantrum in written format. Because, of course, he is a man who spends most of his time watching cable news, getting angry, and getting even angrier because Ron DeSantis, or Ronda Sanctimonious as he calls him, which I've got to admit is pretty funny, was getting all the positive coverage, and he wasn't. And he was being blamed by many for the poor performance of the Republican Party. Not strictly on him, it's as much on people like McConnell, and the fact that the Republican Party is basically a party that is every bit as poisonous and rancid to the American working class as the Democrats are. So what's the actual reality here? Well, the problem for the Republicans, as I see it, and I think that this is what actually was gone on, is that, of course, they vastly overestimated their own popularity. They made a mistake that the Democrats have also made in recent years, which is that they were getting certain parts of their base infused by the demagogic attacks on so-called woke capital, which, by the way, doesn't exist. There's no such thing as woke capital. There's just capital. Capital might wear a woke mask every now and again. They might use it on some advertising, on some branding, and then the next day they'll drop that, start waving an American flag again, and re-employ a new version of the Marlboro Man. This is just how capital moves. It's like advertising and branding mean absolutely nothing. What is popular today is not popular tomorrow. Advertising, branding moves in cycles. You look at the history of the advert and you can see that. Yes, a lot of the woke stuff that like the Democrat-aligned people and some of the American left engage in are very annoying. But as the Republicans find out, just by demagoguing around that, you can't make a campaign over it. You can't craft a compelling narrative over it. Trump and the degree of popularity that he did get in 2016 was got largely through the sheer unpopularity of Hillary fucking Clinton, and also because he made some noises about taking on the elites and protectionism and rebuilding the American industrial base. As I said yesterday, Biden has continued that because this is bigger than, of course, Trump and Biden. This is the capitalist cycle moving through its different phases, moving out of a period of globalization and moving into a period of protectionism and reinforced blocks. And of course, the concern of the American ruling class, increasingly so at this stage in the cycle, is now they want to try and resecure themselves on the home front, which means rebuilding something of an industrial base, or trying to, though that is going to prove especially difficult for the American bourgeoisie, considering that they've gone so far down the route of deindustrialization, far further than even the British bourgeoisie had gone in the crisis of the 1930s. But the problems for them, of course, don't stop this desire and this need for a rebuilding of the American industrial base making its way into the political system, which is what's going on right now. However, the big problem is that, of course, the cost of labor in the United States is still too high for capital, which means, of course, as I said yesterday, the need of the American bourgeoisie is to find somebody who can, or a series of people who can, lead an assault on the American working class to force down labor costs in order that any such reindustrialization can be done effectively, i.e. effectively in terms of delivering profits. So they are looking for a leader who can do that for them. They don't want Trump because they don't think he's reliable enough to do it. They're thinking about DeSantis. They're thinking about maybe some other people. Pompeo might throw his hat into the ring, though God knows whether he would have any popularity outside of a small clique of MEK terrorists based in Albania. Who knows? So there has been a number of articles floating around, including from one of the editors of Compact, Sohrab Amari, saying that the Republicans should do X, Y, and Z to appeal to blue-collar workers, which, of course, they could do, in theory, and saying that this would be good politics if they did it. Well, let's think about that for a moment. Let's think about the last time the Republican Party in the United States actually went through some kind of transformation and adopted some kind of populism, to use the term of the moment. Well, that was roughly over 100 years ago. That was in the time of Theodore Roosevelt, or Teddy Roosevelt, who took over after the assassination of William McKinley and adopted some of the things that had been talked about by the populist movements of the late 19th century. And it's here worth just diving a little bit into the history of American populism and labor populism in the late 19th century in the USA. After the end of the Civil War, the upsurge in labor activism really began, though of course there were some labor struggles in the USA going back to at least the 1820s in the mills of New England. But the upsurge in labor activism really begins after the Civil War ends, and of course the industrial expansion of the United States really takes off in a big way, to the point where it's easily starting to rival and in many areas surpass the British in the 1870s and 80s. So of course this triggers a wave of labor activism as well, even though this is often violently suppressed in the United States by the ruling class. And this is something which leads into, or partly feeds into, the populist wave of the 1880s and 90s, which, even though it was defeated in the form of a presidential candidate, William Jennings Bryan, which was a campaign which drew from the not just labor populism, but countryside populism, the populism of the farmers, and the Free Silver campaign, which was, of course, popularized by William Jennings Bryan. And a part of that was his famous Cross of Gold speech. But all of this was the background to the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. Now, of course, Theodore Roosevelt, being from an elite patrician family on the northeast of the United States, was no natural-born populist, but he was, of course, a man who was an extremely effective politician. And he picked up on a lot of these themes and, of course, turned some of them, at least, into Republican Party policy, and later went much further when he ran as an independent on the Bull Moose ticket in the late 1900s after he'd served his two terms as president. So what my point is here is that when the Republican Party went through this shift into running under a populist president, even though he was a president who, of course, came in thanks to an assassination, but the point still stands, this was as a part of a growth in labor unrest, in unrest in the countryside, in years of both militant working class campaigns and populist campaigns from the farming communities, which put a great deal of pressure on the American capitalist class, even though, of course, they managed to violently suppress a lot of this. But that background of the movement of the working class and the pressure from the farmers created a political opening into which someone like Teddy Roosevelt could step. Now, my point about this is that the populism of that time, as expressed by Roosevelt in his presidency throughout the 1900s and other Republican politicians at the time, was against the background of a rising and strengthening organized working class. And, of course, the need of the American ruling class to actually deal with the rising class conflicts and the rising class consciousness of the American working class. Because in that early period of the 20th century, in that period of the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt, the full expectation of many people inside the European socialist movement and the old Second International was that it was going to be the American working class that would be the leaders of the revolutionary movement. And they had a good reason to think so. They saw the rapid growth in trade unionism, the growth of various American socialist parties, the growth in syndicalism inside, certainly the Northeast and Midwest cities in the United States. They had good reason to think that. And so the American ruling class needed a response to that, to manage that situation, not just violent suppression, though that was always part of their tactics, but also accommodating to it by making certain reforms. Also, American capitalism at the time is on a huge upswing, as is the productivity of American agriculture, giving the United States the basis of the dominant capitalist economy that would be the defining capitalist economy of the 20th century. The earlier 20th century, for all the repression that was unleashed by the American capitalist class, was also a time of progressively rising wages. And therefore, even with all the horrors that the American capitalist class could inflict on the American worker when the American working class was trying to organize themselves, the spectacular growth of American capitalism meant that it was a time of reform, a time of rising incomes, a time of increasing consumption, the birth of the consumer society, etc. So all of that, therefore, put us in a very different picture in terms of the ability of the system to actually offer reform for the working class. The system, as it is right now, cannot afford to do so. The attempt by the American ruling class to actually bring back some manufacturing to their shores, as is happening now, as will continue to happen as we move into a phase of increased protectionism, will not go hand in hand with an across-the-board increase in wages. Now, what the American ruling class may try to do is they may try to assert themselves in terms of their domination over the South American nations and the Central American nations. And that may take the form of increasingly vicious attempts at things like military coups rather than the slightly more subtle but nonetheless violent, that color evolutions that they have been trying for the past decade or so, they may revert back to the simple old method of gunboat diplomacy. Because what they need to do is to secure markets for themselves, to secure resources, to secure labor to exploit. And also, if they're going to carry out acts of repression in terms of the domestic working class and making labor inside the United States itself cheaper in terms of its ability to be hired by the capitalist, then what they will need to do is to find some other way of lowering prices for the American workers so that they can look as if they've done something in terms of actually enabling the American working class to have a slightly decent standard of living. And the only way that they can do that is by, of course, engaging in increasingly aggressive acts of imperialism and predatory actions all over the world, specifically in areas where they can project a great deal of force, which is, of course, close to home, which means Latin America and the Caribbean. And what would they be looking for initially? They would be looking for, of course, cheap food, cheap agricultural products that can be reproduced even cheaper than the American farming corporations can do so. So they will also be looking for, of course, outsourced labor, cheap labor to be employed in American-owned factories, cheaper commodities that can be produced outside the United States and brought in. Same trick the British ruling class has been doing for 150-odd years, which is producing certain essentials of life outside of the borders of the imperialist hegemon to be brought in and sold cheaper to the working class and provide them with something that is cheaper to buy whilst at the same time keeping their wages down. These are all the tricks that imperialism will try and use. None of that points to an ability of either of the parties of the American oligarchy to move in the direction of the early 20th century Theodore Roosevelt style or even New Deal style politics. Now, even with the New Deal, even with FDR's time, where even though American capitalism had lurched into crisis, it was still a capitalism which had been going through years of dynamic growth. And it was still a capitalism with some juice left in it. Now, American capitalism is in a much weaker place. So what is on the cards for the American worker is certainly not the development towards any kind of populism of the right or the left variety of the religious-inspired or the Catholic-inspired, as people like Sahrab Amari want to see happen, but more likely going in the direction of Bonapartism and fascism. Because if they can't crush the American worker with the employment of force via the official organs of the state, then fascism will rapidly follow. And that is what is on the cards, not just, of course, in the United States, but across Europe. If there is, and there will be, an increased and intense class struggle as the ruling classes of Europe desperately try to reassert profitability and engage in protectionism to defend their industries, their market shares, etc., then concomitant with that comes, of course, the return of a real form of fascism, not the pretend fake kind that the soft left have been complaining about for years, but the real fascism that only derives from a crisis in capitalist production, a acute series of class struggles which may produce revolutionary opportunities which, if missed, will certainly lead to the imposition of a fascist regime in certainly Britain, which is heading down that road, and ultimately, of course, in the other major capitalist powers of Europe, Germany and France, and, of course, the other lesser powers where there is, of course, a history of fascism as well, Spain, Italy, Greece. This is all on the cards within the next few years if the level of class struggle increases, which it must, because, of course, the level of attacks from the ruling class must increase. And with them losing their ability to simply outsource things to other areas, which may be in a different camp now, maybe more aligned with the Chinese, maybe following a different path of development than previously, in that they were willing to be outsourced areas of production for the imperialist powers, maybe they're now looking to develop in different ways and aren't prepared to have the value extracted from them through the transactions as they were in the past in terms of their ability to provide profits to the imperialists or willingness to. So this is a question which is going to keep recurring, which is the possibilities of reform, the possibilities of so-called populism, the possibilities of social democracy. From the state we are at the moment, though, I would argue that all of those possibilities are closing off. It is much more likely that the ruling class will be following the road of very bitter repression inside the United States. So the kind of party that the more populist inclined, pro-worker, American nationalist elements, as they see themselves, want to see in the form of the Republican Party isn't going to happen any more than the social democratic Swedish model of the 1930s is going to magically emerge inside the Democrats, which is what the DSA say they want. Not going to happen either. Instead, we're going to see a trend towards very much the opposite of that. The only chance, of course, of building anything inside the United States or the European nations that can actually lead any kind of successful working class action is, of course, the building of real and enduring communist parties that have a firm base in the working class, have a truly organic connection with the masses. And if this is achieved, then there will be the chance to actually take those revolutionary opportunities when they arrive. And if we don't, then we are hurtling down the path towards Bonapartism, fascism, and imperialist war. I tend to try and avoid the rather alarmist prognoses of some others, but given the depth of the crisis facing European capitalism and American capitalism as well, this is all what is on the cards. And though we should be cautious about applying the term fascism to anything that is vaguely reactionary, it is important to realize that it is a very real possibility in our near future. So, now turning to a question that I had come in with regard to the podcast I did yesterday, and this is from Ligurio on the Telegram group. Question reads as follows. The numbers of combatants in the Ukraine theater, while large in comparison with recent conflicts in the industrialized world, pale in comparison to early industrialized conflicts, not only World War I and World War II, but also Korea and Vietnam. Do you attribute this to the deindustrializing tendency of advanced capitalism between the 1960s and the present day in Europe and the United States? Are current militaries not as capable of fielding as many soldiers because despite technological advances, or are there other reasons at play here? Well, it's a good question. One of the reasons I said I'd pick this up on the program is because it feeds into a lot of what we discuss here. And one of the biggest reasons why the vast mobilizations that the imperialist powers carried out between the early part of the 20th century and World War I and the late 60s, early 70s, is because the mass mobilization of men and resources and women into the workforce in the early 20th century created an awful lot of social chaos inside the countries in question. And capitalist countries generally don't like to have huge standing armies or national service, even though they've had to at various different points in their recent histories. The British ruling class, for instance, even though they became the predominant imperial power in the 19th century, did so with a standing army that was still relatively small. They didn't have national service. And for instance, they demobilized their army that they'd had to recruit to fight the Napoleonic Wars with very quickly after 1815, because there was a long-standing distrust within the British ruling class of vast standing armies, possibly dating back to their fears that had been generated by the rebellion of the New Model Army in the 17th century, in the period of the English Civil War and Revolution. So they've generally, the British ruling class certainly wanted to keep away from having vast standing armies. They controlled their empire with a lot of local troops who had been recruited from the native populations of the colonized nations. So they generally used a British officer corps to do it, but they preferred a light touch wherever they possibly could. Of course, they had to dump that model when it came to World War I. They'd even had to partially shed it when they did a mobilization for the Boer War, which in the Second Boer War, that is, which was when they actually had to start taking the nutritional requirements of the working class a little bit more seriously, considering they were going to be faced with an imperialist war soon. Because they found that so many of the working class population that were mobilized in the Boer War were malnourished and too weak and too short to actually fulfill the role of infantry. So, and again, this recurred in the early part of the mobilization for World War I, where they found that the recruits that they were bringing in, being young men between the ages of 18 to 25 were often much shorter than the officers and much weaker in terms of their physical abilities when they came in. So they had to spend the first month training them and feeding them up. And the average man who was recruited grew an inch in height and put on a stone just by having a regular 3 meals a day and regular exercise. Doesn't feel like much of a good trade, though, when a lot of them would have gone off and got their brains blown out for Britain, but there you go. That's an interesting side note. But the mobilization, of course, created these vast armies in World War One, and it also unleashed a lot of social chaos when you had to demobilize these men, a lot of whom were damaged in various different ways, both physically and mentally. And, of course, taking a load of men out of the workforce and dumping them into uniform and having them fight a war for a few years, of course, created a lot of disturbance, which also needed the ruling class to make concessions. So the final thing that caused the ruling class to have to concede the vote to women was, of course, that they had to employ women in huge numbers in factories in World War One. And that was the final thing that pushed equality in the voting sphere over the edge. It had to happen after they had to mobilize millions of women in the factories. But to return to Ligerio's question, the American ruling class moved away from mobilization on a draft scale after Vietnam, because the experience of the Vietnam War led to widespread societal unrest. And it was also a huge expense. Maintaining these armies and the huge amount of weaponry, supply chains, and orienting the economy around supplying them is a huge expense. And one of the things that it's important to keep in mind is that, of course, it was the expense of this vast military deployment that the Americans were doing, and not just in Vietnam, but of course the huge numbers they kept in Japan, in Korea, in Europe, was draining the American capitalist economy of resources, and of course was part of the reason why they had to dump the gold standard and move to a fiat currency. And this is a huge problem, because even though the American ruling class managed to keep up a sizable army up until the end of the Cold War, it was still not enough. If you listen to, again, mention the account given by Scott Ritter when he was talking about his experience in the Marine Corps running war games in the early 1980s, that the calculations he was doing as an intelligence and planning officer, and this is backed up by accounts of other men at the time as well, was that if there was a full-on conflict with the Soviets had actually the advantage in terms of aircraft, in terms of artillery, and in terms of manpower. Now, the US and the British still had a slight advantage at sea, but the Soviets also had a huge advantage in terms of potential nuclear weapons as well. Maybe not huge, but they certainly had the numbers on the United States and the other NATO countries. And the accounts from back in the day was that the military advantage of the United States was rapidly disappearing, because the American military was actually weakening, even though there was this much heralded and talked about military buildup that was done by Reagan in the early 1980s. So he spent a lot more. There was a big recruitment drive for the US, but they'd had to do away with conscription and the draft because of the societal chaos that it inflicted upon the ruling class towards the end of the 60s and into the early 1970s, because of the revolts inside the American army, the killing of officers, the effect that the draft refuseniks had in terms of their ability to create problems for the American military back at home. All of this led them to think that it wasn't worth it anymore and it was time to get rid of it. But of course, that creates a problem, which is, of course, that they had to enhance the package that was available for volunteer soldiers. So essentially, they had to engage in a bit of military social democracy to get more people in. So offering health care for you and your family, education, etc., for the GI Bill. The expense of the military kept continuing to grow. So if you're a capitalist country, yeah, you want to a advanced and numerous military that can fight the damn commies. But by the middle of the 80s, it was something that was a real drain and still is a drain on American capitalism, even though it was making some capitalists a lot of money. It was, of course, unbalancing the American economy. So this myth that gets perpetuated by American right-wingers that, oh, we spent the Soviet Union into the ground, isn't actually true. If anything, the American capitalists had almost been spent into the ground by the Vietnam War and were looking pretty shaky themselves by the early 1980s. Again, real tragedy of all of this is that the treachery and of Gorbachev and the others at the top of the Soviet Union killed the Soviet Union off at a time when the capitalists themselves were running on fumes. It was the huge boost that the counter-revolution in the east of Europe and the USSR gave them, that, and together with the opening up of China, which has given them the last 30 years, and look what they've done with it. But to return to Ligerio's question, the doing away of the vast militaries was, of course, a peace dividend for the capitalists, that another gift from the wretch Gorbachev, which they did spend. I mean, in the 1990s, look at what happened with all the militaries of Europe. They no longer wanted to spend the enormous amount of money maintaining like these giant armies. So all of them, yeah, the British, the French, the Spanish, the Italians, all cut down their militaries all the way through the 1990s, as did, by the way, all of the Eastern European countries. All did away with conscription, all did away with the numerous armies that had been part of the Warsaw Pact, because capital doesn't want to spend the money anymore. And of course, as Ligerio's question implies, the outsourcing and the deindustrialization of these countries meant that, of course, they didn't have the capacity to actually supply vast armies anymore, nor did they think they needed to. The reorientation of the British defense doctrine in the 2000s was all about having this light footprint approach whereby they would control countries via small deployments of forces. If you look at how the British military is scattered all the way across the world, what they have is some significant bases. So, for instance, there's still a small but significant presence in Kenya to control that. There's a base in Cyprus, which causes all kinds of problems for the locals. There's military bases in the Middle East. For instance, the British have a small but significant naval base in Qatar, I believe. And they, of course, have military presence in places like Brunei. And they have still military presence in Australia. All of these are very small. The idea being that, of course, a small detachment of special forces and some trainers for the local forces can avoid the necessity of a vast deployment of British forces that would be noticeable and would be costly. So, again, we return to the old imperial doctrine of, well, better to have a few good officer types to run things and leave things generally up to the locals, as long as you're doing the training and setting the doctrine. And this is the model that the British use now. They take officer corps and the elite, the sons of the elite, and train them at Sandhurst, make sure that they've received a thorough dose of a good old British military education, then send them home with a few officers and maybe some SAS men to take control of their local forces and to run the local forces. And this is the British defense doctrine now. Nuclear weapons to, you know, be retained in order to be so-called taken seriously and retain Britain's seat at the top table in the UN as a nuclear power. But everything else run very cheaply, run without the need to retain a vast industrial base, without the need to spend huge amounts on soldiers, including having to pay for their healthcare, pay for their benefits, pay for their pensions, etc. Remember also that when the British did do a significant deployment to Iraq, they ran into all kinds of trouble with the wounded men that came back, and they had to open up specialist areas inside the NHS hospitals because the military hospitals have been stripped bare over the previous 10 years. So capitalists don't actually like spending an awful lot of money on infantry, on soldiers. They do like producing vast quantities of weaponry that can be sold over the odds prices, though. That's another thing entirely. So to conclude on the question then, the relative smallness of the major armies of the Western capitalist powers certainly comes from the fact that they rather arrogantly and hubristically thought that that time had gone and they didn't need any of this anymore. And of course, it fitted in completely with deindustrialization and the move towards, of course, the globalized system, which they felt they could keep in place with a minimal deployment of forces. And you can see how wrong that has gone for the French, for instance, in Mali, where they've recently been forced out of their deployment in Mali. And they are, according to Macron, having to reconsider their anti-terrorist efforts. And that was like a classic case of like this, for this 90s to 2000s deployment of the forces of an imperialist power with a minimum force that they hoped to be able to use to control a country. Done under the false basis of, we're using this to fight terrorism. If it had been now, they'd probably say they were using them to fight climate change. All bullshit just to keep French dominance over the Malian natural resources, of course, and to make sure that the favorable terms of trade available to the French capitalists were kept in place. But to conclude on the question, this is it's a combination of things. It's a combination of the fact that capitalists don't like spending money on vast standing armies. They don't trust vast standing armies. They don't like having to do a draft. They don't like having to potentially throw all these generally working class and lower middle class men together to potentially get some radical thoughts if things start going badly at home. They prefer a smaller professional military, and the British always did, that was completely reliable, that was as drawn from the, in terms of the rank and file, from the most poor elements in a society, from the most disorganized sections of the working class and the lumpens, who could easily be unleashed on the working class if strictly required. So, again, I think the biggest factor here is, of course, cost. But the wider factor is, of course, the evolving nature of imperialism in the over the last 30 years, complete with the deindustrialization being part of it, and the wish to run things with a sort of light touch element to it. And, of course, this was part of the thinking of Donald Rumsfeld as well. Even as far back as the 1970s, he was looking to see how much they could save on the American military. He couldn't really do that in the Cold War, but he did do it in the 2000s. And the big criticism of him that came from like the American right after the invasion of Iraq was that Rumsfeld had maintained true to his doctrine of running the whole thing as cheaply as possible. And of course, this is a big part of the reason why when it all went tits up in Iraq and Iraqis started shooting back at them, they had to extend tours of duty in the American military on for the regular soldiers. They had to call up National Guard units over and over again to serve long tours of duty in Iraq. And of course, this was all part of the reason why Rumsfeld was eventually jettisoned as defense secretary, because he was seen to have gone so wrong. But significantly enough, the American defense doctrine hasn't really changed. It's still being run on the basis of Rumsfeld's reforms. There is still an awful lot of money spent, of course, but that doesn't mean to say that they are spending it on infantrymen. But one of the things that, of course, the Russia-NATO war in Ukraine has revealed is, of course, if you don't have enough infantry in this, even in this supposedly high-tech period of warfare, then you can't do anything. And this is the problem that was faced has faced the Russian commanders, which is that due to political constraints, which were imposed from the beginning due to the fact that the Russian political leadership was afraid of calling immediately for mobilization. They didn't think they had the political strength to do so and didn't want to actually engage in this war, which has been forced upon them now. They went in limited, and it turns out they couldn't fight that way. They couldn't fight that way and actually achieve their objectives of taking Donetsk and Lugansk. They couldn't defend the huge 1,000-kilometer front line that they had across the territories of the former Ukraine without a significantly larger military grouping. And as time goes on, if, to return to the point where we started this program, if there is no deal, if there is no even a tacit understanding, shall we say, reached between the United States and the Russians, and if this war has to carry on and on and on, the Russians are going to need to keep mobilizing. They're going, because if they need to keep on fighting these Ukrainian armies, that as long as the Kiev regime stands, and for as long as the Americans and the Europeans are able to continue propping it up or being willing to prop it up, and the Ukrainian regime can still call up men to go and get fed into this meat grinder in the east, then the Russians are going to need to take more and more of the territory. And if they end up having to take all of the bloody place, then they're going to need an awful lot of men to hold it. And so, again, we come back to the fact that capitalist nations don't like mass mobilizations. They don't like huge standing armies. But in the case of the Russians, they're going to need to re-find that tradition again. The Russian army, even back in the days of Imperial Russia, was famous for being huge, but of course this huge peasant force that was mobilized by the Russian Imperial Army long since had bitten the dust. The Red Army, as it was a very large force, but it was a very professional one in terms of its, even its enemies recognized that its training programs and its military doctrine was very professionally put together. Its soldiers were trained to a standard at least as high, possibly higher than the West in terms of their ability to actually fight and put an army in the field. They were very well respected. And they could have won a military encounter against the Western forces. Certainly that's what several of the American observers thought. But some of those traditions are going to need to be re-embraced by the Kremlin as time goes on, because, again, if there's no arrangement here, if there's no bargaining to be done, if the US can't reach a point where it can reach a consensus inside its own White House as to what they're going to do, then this war's just going to keep going on. And maybe it's reached the point where, as somebody else actually pointed out in the discussion in the Telegram group, perhaps it is the case that the Russians now regard the Americans as completely unreliable and not worthy of signing an agreement with. Now, I don't know whether the Kremlin leadership actually would not sign an agreement with the Americans if one came along, but on Ukraine, who knows? I mean, again, the time will tell over the next few weeks whether any agreement has been reached. But again, to emphasize the point, if one isn't reached, then they will need to mobilize the economy and their society in ever-increasing numbers. They'll need to do another wave of call-up of their reservists. They'll need to bolster the ranks of the armed forces in order that they can take and hold large areas of Ukraine. Because if they intend to go back to Kherson, for instance, as Medvedev and others have said, then they will need more men to do it. They will need more men to actually assault that area again. Unless, of course, they're thinking that they just keep grinding away and slowly moving through Donbass, and, of course, the Ukrainians keep throwing men at them to die in vast numbers, that eventually they're going to cause the collapse of the Ukrainian state. Maybe they're right. It's difficult to say at this stage. Maybe they're thinking that ultimately the plug will get slowly pulled, and then they can just cut a deal with what is left of the Ukrainian state when this regime has collapsed. Again, time will work that out. At the moment, things are a little bit unclear on that. But to finalize the point on this question, the at time when the big powers of the world didn't actually have vast militaries is going away again. Now, whether the Europeans and the British can manage to actually secure huge militaries for themselves again, whether they can rebuild their industrial bases again, is all going to be subject to vicious class wars in these countries, because they may look to do so. They may look to rebuild their militaries. They may look to rebuild some kind of Europe-wide military capacity. That is something which is very much on the cards right now. The Americans are looking suspiciously at the French and the Germans again, because they've brought up the point again about the EU building a military capacity. The British have said they want to be involved with it, which has sent the British right wing into a paroxysm of despair. Because, of course, this is one of the big reasons they wanted to be out of the EU. They didn't want an EU army. But the French and the Germans are now seeing it makes sense from their perspective. But, of course, they require the cooperation, if they're going to build something, of the mad dogs of Warsaw and even madder yapping dogs of the Baltic. And I can't see them cooperating with this anytime soon. So, again, something to keep an eye on in terms of developments there. The EU military capacity, or perhaps a military capacity built jointly by France, Germany, perhaps Spain, perhaps Italy, perhaps Portugal, leaving out the American puppets in the East. Who knows? So I hope that answers the question from Ligurio there. There are other things that have come up in the Telegram chat today, but as we're already hitting an hour, I'll answer those in the program tomorrow. Stay tuned for further things coming up over the course of the next few days. I'll finally be getting around to actually recording the Q&A for patrons, and that includes everything from the usual questions about Stalin to questions of political organization. I hope to be able to be putting that out on Sunday, say, so stay tuned for that if you're a Patreon subscriber. But until tomorrow on the next update, thank you for listening, and I will be leaving you with some appropriate music.